From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For more than a century, the New York Times has been reporting the news without fear or favor worldwide. For the past 3.5 years, much more often than it would like, the Times has also become the news in one journalistic scandal and misstep after another. Author Seth Mnookin, who covered the paper for Newsweek magazine during this turbulent period, believes he's found the source of the problem, which he identifies in his new book, Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. He joins us now. Seth, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's review for a moment some of the bad things that happened at the New York Times over a period of about 2 years. Young reporter Jason Blair was caught fabricating at least 36 stories in the national section. Feature writer Rick Bragg was caught doing very colorful descriptions of people and places he'd barely visited, relying on notes from uncredited stringers. Judith Miller was outed as an uncritical purveyor of Ahmad Chalabi's since discredited intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, if your book has a central premise, it's that these events are not isolated, that they were rooted in one central problem. And that problem was named...
I think you're getting to Hal Raines and his leadership. He took over the paper the week before September 11, 2001, and then his tenure lasted until June 2003 when he was fired in the wake of Jason Blair.
Your book so indicts Raines for arrogance, egotism, narcissism. Could it possibly be so simple? And could he possibly have been so bad at his job? Would these three otherwise isolated incidents not have happened had Raines not been executive editor of the New York Times?
Let's go through them one by one. I think it's impossible to be 100% certain about every story every day. What was, I think, unique about Jason's situation is that there were warning signs that cropped up again and again during his six-month sort of reign of journalistic terror. Jill Abramson, who at the time was the Washington bureau chief, raised questions about a story that Jason wrote about the Washington, D.C. area sniper. And because Hal Raines and Jill Abramson had their own interpersonal problems, Raines didn't want to hear it. John Landman, the Metro editor, who had been Jason's direct supervisor for several years, also had a lot of concerns about Jason. It's unclear if those concerns made their way to Hal Raines, but what is clear is when Hal was sending attaboy memos to Jason about a story that ended up being one of the ones that was problematic, he CC'd in Jill Abramson and John Landman. So if Jason had been working under Joe Lelyveld or Bill Keller, would one or two bad stories have made their way into the paper? Probably. Would 36 stories have made their way into the paper? I think that's less likely.
Okay, how about Rick Bragg and Judith Miller?
Well, Rick Bragg, I think, in some weird way, got a raw deal. Rick had always been a reporter who was treated differently from other reporters. He was given more leeway. He was given more help on his stories. So I think what happened with Bragg is the rules changed in the middle of the game for him. With Judith Miller, I think that's an excellent example of something that likely would not have happened under a different executive editor. She is an expert on the Middle East and also on terrorism, and any newspaper would have deployed her to cover that story. However, the editor, who was also an expert, Steve Engelberg, and who had worked with Miller on stories and on books, who knew this subject as well as she did, had left the paper because he couldn't work with Hal Raines. And so there was an example where the one person inside the institution who had the knowledge to say, you know what, why don't we ask ourselves why Chalabi is pushing this story? Why don't we ask ourselves if Iraq actually has the capacity to make these roving weapons factories? He was gone. He had gone to the Portland Oregonian. The man who replaced Steve Engelberg as investigative editor, a guy named Doug Franz, also left and went to the LA Times because he didn't want to work under Hal Raines either. And that, to me, is a very clear example of where you see a ripple effect of what happened under Hal Raines' leadership.
Now, I must say I found your book absolutely delicious and filled with just the most wonderful detail. Frankly, a lot of gossip value for
someone who
professionally finds fault for a living.
Right.
I'm wondering, though, outside of those of us in this very small circle of media navel gazers, the book really has a larger significance.
I think so, and I hope so. I think the big issue facing the media world right now is the fact that you have these institutions like the New York Times and other great daily papers, network news, that are losing their audiences. And they're trying to figure out a way to remain relevant. And to me, one of the big stories of Howell Raines' tenure is he got that position by selling himself to the publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, as someone who had figured out a way to revitalize, and these were terms he used, the New York Times, to make it more exciting, to sex it up. And I think what you saw is a product that was changing, that was no longer giving readers what they had come to rely upon and expect. And the fact that Raines is no longer at the New York Times doesn't change the notion and the reality, I think, that all of these old guard journalistic institutions are going to need to find a way to hold on to their core values and at the same time convince people who are under 30 that these are products that can have meaning in their lives as well.
So is the lesson, in your judgment, not to pander to audiences and instead to rely on those core values?
I don't think it needs to be an either or. One of the interesting things, if you look at the New York Times now, is that Bill Keller has instituted a lot of the ideas that Howell Raines was talking about. One of the things he really wanted to focus on was updating the culture pages, revitalizing the book review, having more pop culture and more popular music and less opera and less classical recitals. And all that has happened under Bill Keller. I think you can be mindful of what your audience is looking for and at the same time retains your core identity as an institution. The Times' core identity is its reliability, its completeness, and its accuracy.
Okay. Well, Seth, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Former Newsweek media reporter Seth Mnookin is the author of Hard News, The Scandals of the New York Times, and Their Meaning for American Media.
When a reputable newspaper lies, it poisons the community. Every newspaper story becomes suspect, declared a New York Times editorial. Great publications magnify the voice of any single writer. Thus, when their editors or publishers want or need to know a source for what they print, they have to know it and be able to assure the community or the courts that they do. Where this is not now the rule, let this sad affair at least have the good effect of making it the rule. That editorial was published on April 17, 1981, about the transgressions of a Washington Post reporter named Janet Cook. Cook was 26, talented, and black, a big plus in a mostly white newsroom in a mostly black city. She was rapidly promoted. She wrote a powerful piece about drug abuse in D.C., centered on an 8-year-old heroin addict named Jimmy. She won the Pulitzer Prize. Then it became apparent that she'd invented her star character. She was in many ways like Jason Blair.
These were both attractive people. I mean, they were smart. They were articulate. Editors get caught up with them, and they perhaps give them too long a leash to operate in ways that perhaps some other reporters don't get to operate.
Michael Gettler is a former Post reporter and editor, now its ombudsman. He says that after the Cook debacle, the paper changed.
One of the things that did happen at the Post is that the star system was diminished. There was also, I think, an immediate impact on the culture of the newsroom. It was clear that editors had to inquire more frequently about the sources of stories, that communications generally had to be improved throughout the newsroom. There had to be a much more open process so that doubts by reporters or junior editors about particular stories could surface.
Back then, the Post was run by Ben Bradley, a flamboyant, autocratic, risk-taking editor like the Times' Howell Raines. The newsroom culture was similar, and their scandals were similar, but not entirely the same.
The kind of thing that Jason Blair did is very different from what Janet Cook did.
Hendrik Hertzberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
You know, hers was a great big invention. Janet Cook's was more like a big bank robbery, and Jason Blair's was more like gradual embezzlement.
So the editors responsible for Cook failed to catch her in her one big lie. But the Times' top editors had plenty of chances to catch the myriad distortions of Jason Blair. One prominent reason they didn't? Blair's victims never called to complain. Some critics say that's because they had no one to complain to.
Thank you for calling the reader comment line at the New York Times. Your message will reach a responsible editor very promptly. If you're calling as an individual about a correction or with a coverage question we can answer, we will try to reply.
I think readers want to have someone, a name, that they can call and ask for and talk to instead of just leaving a message. It's very impersonal, but I think it's arrogant.
Lou Gelfand is the longest-running ombudsman in American journalism, serving that role for the Minneapolis Star Tribune for the last 22 years. The ombudsman is the person to complain to, an independent observer, neither apologist nor scold. But he takes the complaints and unpacks them, usually in a column, and responds to hundreds of readers a week.
I think they can enhance the newspaper's credibility by taking an issue and discussing it thoroughly, and if the ombudsman feels that the paper blew it, was wrong, to say so.
The Washington Post had an ombudsman back in 1981, but no ombudsman could have prevented the Cook debacle. But what about Jason Blair? Daniel Okrent is the Times ombudsman hired a year ago.
I think that they are so hypersensitized to this, and they've created new systems and new jobs, internal jobs, to prevent this sort of thing from happening again. They don't need me to do that, frankly.
Maybe that'll be a lasting legacy of Jason Blair. Better communication among high and low-level editors, and better checking up on facts, starting with a reporter's resume straight through to his confidential sources. But as the Times noted in its editorial in 1981, that should have been the lasting legacy of Janet Cook. I put it to the Post ombudsman, Michael Gettler. Did Janet Cook have any lasting impact on the profession? Because it sure doesn't seem like it.
Well, it's like the Vietnam War. You know, you get a new generation of reporters who don't even know about it or hadn't heard about it or weren't aware of the impact of it. But I think it did put in place a general culture which guards against that happening again.
So you think maybe you need a Janet Cook or a Jason Blair in every generation?
Well, hopefully not. I mean, hopefully you don't need that, but it sure provides a stimulus.
Newspaper corrections, broadcast quick fixes, and tricks for sounding as good as me on the radio.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we were inundated by images of catastrophe on an epic scale. Many of them, grisly vacation videos of a frantic and futile race against a wave of water, a powerful reminder of how small the world has become and how clearly we see each other and how clearly others see us across the globe. The first reports were from English-speaking tourists, survivors with cameras, whose stories in some ways obscured the true extent of the calamity for the people who live there. But ultimately, this horror, like most these days, was recorded, demanding a response, as such pictures always do, from every citizen of the world. Consider the parade of nightmarish images just this year. The beheading of hostages, torture at Abu Ghraib, 300 children killed in Beslan, Russia. And what of the images we haven't seen? The dearth of pictures from Darfur, for instance. Is it better to see or not to see? Does it spur us to responsible action or exhaust our empathy? This week, the answer was clear. In just 3 days, individual Americans donated $18 million to the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. But natural disaster is uncomplicated. Not so mayhem wrought by man. Images of war inevitably are colored by how they are presented, who presents them, and why. The great culture critic Susan Sontag, who died this week, wrote 2 years ago in The New Yorker that, quote, photographs of an atrocity may give rise to opposing responses, a call for peace, a cry for revenge, or simply the bemused awareness, continually restocked by photographic information, that terrible things happen. The dead, she continued, are supremely uninterested in the living, in those who took their lives, in witnesses, or in us. Why should they seek our gaze? What would they have to say to us? We, this we, is everyone who has never experienced anything like what they went through, don't understand, can't understand, can't imagine. But though the dead are no longer interested in us, we cannot afford to lose interest in them. What, after all, she asked, is the alternative? That images of carnage be cut back to, say, once a week? No committee of guardians is going to ration horror. In this argument over images, I stand in favor of more, not less. But as in all things media, we can't be passive as we stare into the faces of the dead. We can't allow a picture to stand in for the truth. We have to seek it out, and we have to act, because we can. For some readers of the august New York Times, there's nothing more perversely satisfying than catching an embarrassing gaffe, major or minor, in its pages. We know the Times makes mistakes, but did you know it makes an average of 7 a day? That's about 2,500 a year. Times editors Dylan Loeb McLean and Linda Amster collected some of their favorite errors and put them in a book called Kill Duck Before Serving. I had to ask them, why so many mistakes?
There are 138,000 words every day in the paper on average, and 317,000 on Sundays. And when you have, obviously, you're publishing so much, it's almost a given that you're going to make at least some errors, because we know everybody makes mistakes. We just put it in a place where everybody can see them.
And actually, I think that after the Times started putting its corrections in a specific place every day and made it a regular part of the paper that was easy to find, other papers followed suit. So in a way, we spearheaded that.
Given that all of these, the numbers you have are fluid, what is the most common error? Is there one?
I'd say probably a spelling.
It's got to be spellings. Mm-hmm.
And what is the most common misspelling?
Well, I think the Edgar Allan Poe was up there.
Allen and Allan Poe.
Yes. We also got Philip Morris, the name of the company, wrong.
That's a question of one L in the Philip or two?
Yes exactly. We counted up 128 times. And that's not necessarily all of them. That just means at least that many.
Another correction that pattern that we find is in terms of a chapter, sorry, wrong number.
You want to give me a handy example?
The one that begins the chapter is one of our favorites, which is the Ivana Trump one. An article about Ivana Trump and her spending habits misstated the number of bras she buys. It is 2 dozen black, 2 dozen beige, and 2 dozen white, not 2,000 of each.
You know, I saw that. That was the subject of some considerable conversation in certain circles in New York.
When you saw it without the correction, you mean.
Exactly. People said, can this be true?
Another one, which is one of my favorites in that chapter, is a chart listing the projected cost of closing the Air Force Laboratory in Rome, New York, misstated the October 13th, 1994 estimate of how much space would be needed for a new location for the lab. It is 328,000 square feet, not 0.328.
And I'll just give you one more. It was about the size of Leonard Bernstein's, the dimensions of his Bösendorfer grand piano, and we had to hasten to say that it was 7 feet 4 inches in length, not in height.
Some of the mistakes are so just plain whack. You really can't understand how they could have been made. This is one from June of 2001. A column about restaurants in Beijing misidentified Shen Shuanghai, owner of the home that is now the Bamboo Garden Hotel, site of the Drunken Beauty Veranda restaurant. A reader's email pointed out that Mr. Shen was a prominent businessman and government official. He was not the Qing Dynasty Palace eunuch who designed the gardens.
So close. So close.
Do you happen to remember offhand what is the longest delay between an error being made and it being corrected?
Funny you should mention that one. That's actually one of my absolute favorite ones. June 17th, 1969, there was a special edition of the paper put out to commemorate the landing on the moon. And as part of that special section, there was the following, which was labeled a correction. On January 13, 1920... Topics of the Times, an editorial page feature of the New York Times, dismissed the notion that a rocket could function in a vacuum and commented as follows. Further investigation and experimentation have confirmed the findings of Isaac Newton in the 17th century, and it is now definitely established that a rocket can function in a vacuum as well as in an atmosphere. The Times regrets the error.
I want to thank you both very much for coming up and talking to us about Kill Duck Before Serving.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Linda Amster and Dylan Loeb McLean are the authors of Kill Duck Before Serving, Red Faces at the New York Times. This is a compilation of some of the gray lady's more memorable mistakes.
In one of the most extended corrections of all time, the New York Times ran a 7,600-word postmortem of the Jason Blair scandal, which provided readers with a rare look at its newsroom practices. But the Times isn't the only news organization willing to lift the veil on the process of making media sausage. In a similar spirit of transparency, one of our reporters, John Solomon, suggested that there were aspects of the process here at On the Media that might interest our listeners. In fact, he thought that some of these methods, used not just by NPR but throughout public radio, would come as much of a surprise to them as they did to him. A warning, those who prefer not to peek behind the curtain should turn down the volume for about the next 10 minutes.
Before I started working at On the Media, I was an avid NPR news listener. To me, like many devotees, an important aspect of the network's appeal is how smooth, well-crafted, and polished it sounds. Everyone seems so eloquent. Interviewers ready with a clearly posed, on-point question. Interviewees offering an articulate answer. Rarely an or you know uttered. Correspondents in the field, even when reporting from the middle of the rainforest, are equally cogent and coherent, and hosts move naturally, effortlessly, and spontaneously between stories. That soothing and reliable sound has made the NPR product distinctive from other radio and news media.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Next, the rule of law in Russia.
Tips for senators on how to survive.
Now that I am on the other side of the speaker, it has been fascinating to discover the importance of behind-the-scenes technical packaging in bringing about that effect. Of course, I want to make it clear that I have found the NPR News on-air staff, present company excluded, is indeed smooth and eloquent and normally ask the right question. But they, and now me, aren't as perfect as it once seemed. New York Times media reporter David Carr.
Everybody always sounds erudite and witty on NPR, and I've always wondered why, and I think there probably is some darkroom magic going on there.
My exposure to the darkroom began when I edited my first story. I sat at the digital editing console with a producer listening to an interview with a source I had recorded earlier. With just strokes of the keyboard, he cleaned up and tightened the sound bites I was going to use, taking out sentences, words, and even some of the pauses, making what are called internal edits. Then the various thoughts were woven together technically in a way that would be totally hidden to the listener. In fact, the public is far less aware of editing on radio than on television or in print. For example, to eliminate words, a TV producer has to use more visible means, such as a cutaway shot or jump cut. Newspaper reporters by form must put a break between non-consecutive quotations, among other constraints. David Carr says that at the Times,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
NPR interview subjects almost never complain about the slicing and dicing, in large part because the edits make them sound more articulate without changing the meaning. In fact, what David Carr actually said on tape was,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
While many public radio programs, particularly call-in shows, are live, I was surprised to find out that newsmaker interviews for the daily NPR national news shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, are often not. Usually they are pre-taped and quickly edited down. Likewise, I was stunned when I learned that the main Fresh Air interview is actually condensed from a longer Q&A. And at times, the Car Talk guys will edit in some extra laughs kept on file.
They will do that, I hear.
Here at On the Media, we do even more editing because as a weekly show, we have more time. It helps make us sound far more articulate than we actually are. For example, here's Bob's original question in a recent interview taping with National Journal's Bill Powers.
Now, your column this week says that there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. That is a very serious charge, really, against the media. How true is it? Are the motives really so? Are the motives really so sinister? That's not quite the right word. Are they really so?
You want to say, are they really so vicious?
Mindlessly bloodthirsty. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Here's how it sounded after the editing.
Now, your column this week says there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Further underscoring the invisibility of radio techniques was the answer to a question I asked when I first started at On the Media. Where's Bob? It turns out that OTM's co-host does most of his interviewing and hosting from his home in Virginia, while the rest of us are in the New York City headquarters. That distance could be why I picked one of his mistakes to highlight the editing process. Nothing is so identified with NPR News as its signature field pieces, and nothing is more of a cut-and-paste production collage. My first such story was a media workout day held for reporters by the National Football League's New York Jets at their practice facility.
Anything but score. Say it. Go!
Before I left, a producer suggested I record ambient sound during the drills that could be mixed later into the piece underneath my narration.
Where's the ball?
The coach, oh.
That confused me. As a listener, I had thought that the narration in field pieces was recorded by the reporter at the location.
Oh no!
I guess I should have realized reporters wouldn't always be able to deliver their clear, concise, well-organized prose while also reporting the story. Okay, now that the curtain has been pulled back a bit, the natural question is, so what? Is there any problem that this behind-the-scenes manufacturing process is largely unknown, maybe until now, to the average NPR listener?
I think there's no question that most people listening to NPR programs are unaware of the artifice that's there.
NPR veteran field reporter Alex Chadwick is now the host of the program Day to Day.
Well, why do they try to make it sound that way if it's not that way? It's not real. Well, because the world of presentation in the media really isn't real in that sense. It is real, but it's a kind of a heightened reality. It's a better reality. It's a cleaner and more articulate reality.
By making everyone sound better and increasing the amount of content in the broadcasts, it would seem to be a win-win-win for the network, its sources, and most importantly, its listeners. Yet is there a small sin of omission? NPR may not be actively misleading listeners. But we all know that they don't know how we create the cleaner and more articulate reality. That post-production perfection may be why some sources at the end of a taped interview are apologetic about their perceived lack of perfection, like OTM guest Harper's editor Lewis Lapham.
Lewis, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Brooke, to get it all mixed up, but I mean, you'll be able to cut something out of it, right?
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
Ironically, television is usually seen as the news medium with artifice, while radio is viewed as more authentic. NPR's ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin believes trust in television news has declined in part because viewers see it as overproduced entertainment. Is it possible that the fact listeners are unaware of how much production is involved has helped retain their trust in NPR news? NPR's executive producer for training, Jonathan Kern, is overseeing a year-long project on news standards, which will likely result in the network providing listeners with more information on production techniques. But he doesn't see much utility for the public in adding transparency for transparency's sake.
Do they really want to know how we edited every actuality and whether there were internal edits? I would say no. They probably don't want to or need to know that. Would it be a good idea occasionally to explain how it's done? Absolutely.
It also may be worth examining whether there are normal production elements that may unnecessarily deceive listeners. For example, this is how All Things Considered's Melissa Block introduced a report on President Bush's visit to Singapore.
NPR's Vicky O'Hara is traveling with the president and joins us now from Singapore. Vicky, the centerpiece of this trip to Asia for the president was the annual...
Kern and Dvorkin agree that the use of joins us in an introduction strongly implies that the interview is live, when in fact it may have been taped hours before.
I think it's a morally slippery slope. I think it makes more sense to say, we spoke to Vicky O'Hara a few hours ago, boom, and you take that. The idea of being live is a construct and almost a vanity of the electronic media now.
But again, has any real harm been done? Neither Kern, the former executive producer of All Things Considered, nor the producers here at OTM remember getting even one complaint from a source about how an interview was cut, which is remarkable considering how much editing is done. In fact, the most important reason to be more open about the production process may be as a vaccination in the event of such a complaint in the future. It might help avoid the massive self-flagellation that the New York Times has recently gone through.
As soon as there's the scandal that pops up where somebody's quote got cleaned up and ended up saying exactly the opposite thing of what they intended to say, well, then, of course, we'll all be on some big fatwa about audio rigor and what. But in the meantime, amongst the list of sort of journalistic mis and malfeasance, I think it's below misdemeanor and just above jaywalking. Now, you make sure and clean up my quotes so they sound good, won't you?
They do it for me, David, so I'll do it for you. For On the Media, this... For John Solomon... Okay. One more time. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Coming up, media past and present, how we used radio 65 years ago and how we use radio and everything else today.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at wrjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With the proliferation of media delivered by cable, satellite, and the internet, it's hard to remember that once there was only one kind of box connecting us to the rest of the world, the creaky, squeaky device known as radio. Technology hasn't much changed, but the medium sure has. A company called Great Tapes in Minneapolis has captured an entire day on radio. The station, WJSV in Washington, D.C., the date, September 21st, 1939.
But we didn't want just any critical ear on all this ancient radio. We wanted one that had been recently assaulted by hours and hours of television. Jack Lechner is a film and television producer and author of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, for which he watched a week of television, 12 TVs at once, for 15 hours a day. Jack, how did that compare to 18 hours of old-time radio?
18 hours of radio is a breeze in comparison. I have to say, it wasn't necessarily always better. I mean, when you listen to this 18 hours, it reminds you that, as I say in my book, the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon said that 90% of everything is crap. That certainly applied to a week of watching television, and it certainly applies to a day of listening to the radio.
So give me an example of some monumental crap you heard during this 18 hours.
Well, there are a lot of soap operas, a lot of soap operas. And they're interesting. They're a little different from soap operas now. They're 15 minutes long. Each one has a sponsor because everything has a sponsor. And they have this ironclad format that's almost like kabuki. You know, they start with an organ intro. You hear so much organ in this one day of radio that you can't believe it. There's a show called Your Family and Mine. It's every, soppy, corny thing you've ever heard, all wrapped up into one and very badly acted to boot.
I need you, Judy.
His need is greater.
I can't give you up.
You've got to forget about me.
Judy, I was just a hobo until I met you. You took me by the hand and showed me the way to a new life.
Interestingly, you've got all these hours of soap operas, and just as soap operas do now, the soap operas are the only place where you recognize the class system on radio. And in fact, you know, if you watch, as I did, a week of television now, the soap operas are the only place where you can tell that there are rich people, poor people, middle class people, people of all different economic brackets in America.
The Goldbergs. This was a program that ran for 15 years and moved to television. Now, this kind of
And this is a family who lived on the Lower East Side of New York. This kind of blatant ethnicity is something we haven't begun to see again in mass media until recently. What do you make of that?
Well, there's more of an acknowledgement in all of show business at that point that America is a melting pot and a celebration of that. It goes in some ways straight back to vaudeville. It's also the 30s, you know, it's the Depression, and there's something that actually feels very right when you listen to it about a show about poor people. I have to say, this is one of the cases where nostalgia seems to have gone a long way. When you actually listen to the Goldbergs, it's not that good. Maybe it's just an off episode, but, you know, it's sort of in this uncomfortable boundary between sitcom and soap opera, and I kept listening to it thinking, what was all the fuss about? I can't tell.
It's not even that Jewish.
No, it's just a little, there's a little sprinkling here and there.
Jake, there's clothes and there's clothes.
So what?
Something awfully funny here.
Please, how do you know where these clothes came from? He must have been a chauffeur for rich people before he took this job. And maybe they gave the clothes to him.
But one thing they pulled off very well was the live broadcast of FDR from the Congress. Was that a high point for you?
It was, actually. First of all, it's just remarkable to hear history in the making. And that's why, incidentally, they chose this day, September 21st, 1939, to record. One of the things about FDR is it's the degree to which he doesn't sound like any modern politician.
I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act.
Now, this day in radio begins in Washington, D.C., with Arthur Godfrey, who's so companionable, who has such a way of drawing you into this 1930s sphere. I almost felt a gingham apron materializing around my waist as I listened to him.
He's just great. And that was actually one of the most enjoyable things, was just to listen to this little embryonic portrait of Arthur Godfrey just before he became an enormous national celebrity.
6:29 and a half. This is Thursday morning, September the 21st. If I am not mistook with a mistake, this is the autumnal equinox, isn't it?
This is the part of radio that didn't get hived off to television, the things that aren't enhanced by pictures. And Godfrey, in 1939, is doing pretty much what any DJ does now, except he doesn't have to resort to some of the tactics that Howard Stern does.
And then on around 11 o'clock, you come to the Gene Abbey show, which, you know, we all thought that the infomercial was a new idea, but apparently it's a pretty old idea.
It's remarkable. Here you have a 15-minute infomercial for a Washington department store. Gene Abbey is a woman with kind of cut-glass diction who talks you through what's on sale in each department, floor by floor. That's the whole show.
No longer is that famed hourglass look achieved through tortuous steel casings, lacings, and constant discomfort. Not if you're properly fitted by a competent corsetier. That's why I dropped in at S. Canson to shop foundations.
We think of television now as being the most commercial any medium has ever been. Television now has nothing on 1939. And there's no boundaries between show and commercial. The same person who is delivering the news is, in the next breath, giving you a plug for Arrow Beer, Better Not Bitter. You know, it's really as if Dan Rather were holding up a product at the beginning and end of the CBS News.
How do you like Pepsi-Cola, Mother? You like Pepsi-Cola? Why don't you get a lot of it and keep it around the house and serve it to the kids when they come home from school? It won't hurt them. It's good for them. Wholesome, healthful, made from the essence of pure fruit juices. You couldn't hurt anybody with it. And its tangy fruit flavor appeals to young and old alike. And it's only 5 cents.
What did this day in radio tell you about America in 1939?
It's a slower place. I mean, partly it's a slower place because they've just been through 10 years of depression. But also, the rhythms are slower. I mean, when you listen to Arthur Godfrey in the morning talking about Washington, Washington, D.C. is a small town. You know, half of the Godfrey show is someone left a pair of sunglasses at the corner of 10th and F. You know, come by the station and pick them up. I guess the biggest surprise for me was that commercialism. It's so pervasive in this day of radio. There's a great commercial for Zlotnik the Furrier.
What is that after the Goldbergs?
Actually, that's all through the day. Zlotnik the Furrier in Washington, D.C. anticipated the trouble in Europe and brought a lot of furs over from Europe just before you couldn't get them anymore. And so he's got them at remarkable rates. That's actually, in many shows, the only mention of what's going on in Europe.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jack Leshner, film and television producer, is author of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You.
Now, let's jump from 1939 to 2001. That's when we first aired this piece from 16-year-old Janice Nieves of the South Bronx. We asked her to take us through her media day from the moment she opened her eyes in the morning.
I hate that buzzer. I really do. So I turn it off as soon as I wake up and leave the radio on.
I always sleep with the radio. I can't sleep without it for some reason.
Events up next on Hot 97.
I turn to Hot 97's morning show with Star and Buck Wild. Star calls himself a hater, but he just speaks his mind about everyone. That's all.
I went on a date with somebody, called him up a week later, and says, well, who's this? I said, Star. Call me a beautiful daughter. She said, you mean my 16-year-old daughter? I said, whoa! Whoa!
You know, I'm trying to be like that, especially in school. Like, not caring what anybody think, not being afraid to sit in class and raise your hand and say something when you want to say it, even if it sounds stupid. But then, you know, sometimes he does go overboard.
Anyway, folks, coming up at 7:20, I have a sincere apology in regards to Aaliyah.
Let me tell you, on Monday, after Aaliyah died, you know, that singer and actress who was killed in a plane crash, Star played these special effects, right? Sounds of a woman screaming while a plane goes down. It crashed, and then you didn't hear anything. After that, his co-host walked out on him, and I don't blame her. Then he actually played it again. As one of her fans, I was mad as hell. But the next day, he apologized.
Yeah, I can apologize for Leah's family and her friends and your Hot 97 listeners. Sure, I can apologize. That's nothing that's beyond me.
I accepted his apology. And anyway, my last memory of Aaliyah won't be a sound effect. It'll be her music. I remember when that song came out. I kept playing it over and over again. I used to get in front of the mirror and make believe I was one of her dancers. She was real smooth. She made me feel like I didn't have to try hard. I could just be me. You into me, but I can't let it go so easily. Cartoon time! In the summer, I watched all the cartoons I missed during the school year, like Rugrats. They're so cute!
Angelica!
Oh, hello, Daddy.
Angelica, didn't Daddy specifically explain to you about 100 times how important these papers are?
Yes, Daddy. I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again.
After a while, though, cartoons get boring. And I start to realize, unlike the Rugrats, I'm getting older, and I can't get away with everything. On the number 5 express train into Manhattan, if you don't have music or something to read, you look up and see all these ads. This is one that always seems to catch my eye. It says, Fast Track to Who You Want to Be, and it shows all these college graduates. That's going to be me one day. When I get home, the PlayStation is always on. I've got to remind my brother that he needs a life. I go and see if my mother has the newspaper.
Do you have the paper? You didn't buy the paper? What's going on?
Anyway, at least there's always the internet. The internet is one place I know I can count on to get the story on what's up with the world.
Fans remember Aaliyah, 22-year-old R&B singer killed in a plane crash.
It's also fun to surf the net and check things out. I like to go to a site called diamondsforever.com, where you can customize your own engagement rings. How fat is that? I'm not engaged or anything. I just like to imagine all the diamonds I'll have in the future. Then I go to a website called ontheline.org. It's where I go to speak my mind about different topics, like that song, Because I Got High by Afro Man.
I was gonna clean my room until I got high. I
was gonna get up and find the broom, but then I got high.
Some people think the song encourages teens to get high. I don't think so. I think he's trying to say not to.
I messed up my entire life because I got high.
Look what he lost by getting high.
I lost my kids and wife because I got high. Say what, say what, say what,
say what. Lying in my bed, listening to the radio. I'm by myself. But I feel like people are listening to my thoughts. Somehow, everything seems meant for me. Star of Hot 97 knows I hate that buzzer, so he comes on to make me laugh. When Afro Man sings, I feel like he knows that my father was a drug addict. And when Aaliyah says, if at first you don't succeed, dust yourself off and try again, it makes me think about the 2 years I wasted not going to high school. I'm going back this fall to try again. People are always asking, are we alone in this world? I think not. For On the Media in the Bronx, I'm Janice Nieves. Dust yourself off and try again. You can dust it off and try again, and try again. Cause if at first you don't succeed, you can dust it off and try again.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer. Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. But let's linger a moment on Arun Roth, senior producer since we relaunched OTM 4 years ago. This is Arun's last show as senior producer. He's moving upstairs to become senior editor of PRI's cultural show, Studio 360.
But not before we tear the shroud of secrecy from his many roles on our show. Arun not only helped OTM's train run on time and edited many of our stories, he also chose the bits of music, we call them buttons, that propelled the program between pieces and through breaks, ranging from the downright weird, like this, to the thoughtful, gorgeous, and profound, you know, like this.
Yep, that was Arun. But not only that, he was also OTM's Man of a Thousand Voices, appearing in On the Media parodies as Al Gore, T.S. Eliot, Gandhi, The Thing, Nazis, perverts, robots. Remember these?
You know, in my years as a reporter, I came up with a system for writing a news story you may find helpful, what I call the inverted pyramid technique. Under my plan, you start out with the most essential information, something I like to call the lead, then proceed to lay out...
Between the acceleration and the brakes, between the cylinders and the shaft, between the purchase and the lease, falls the Camry. For thine is the green one. For thine...
Mom, I gotta go. Galacticus is wreaking havoc on the universe, and it's clobbering time.
Oh!
I'm sorry. I appear to have spilled my Rajmataj on your dress.
Rajmataj?
Yes, a delightful and surprising concoction of Darjeeling tea and Yoo-hoo brand chocolate-flavored drink. I find it to be indelicious. May I say you have supple skin?
He just couldn't help himself.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I've been a very naughty journalist. I have the urge to blow this story all out of proportion.
And we couldn't have stopped him if we'd tried. Not that we wanted to.
Ears perked, teeth grinding, hair unruly, bluff, alert,
Bluff, warning, danger, danger, stop the humanoid.
As for his moving off the show, we'd love to stop him, but we can't. He was present at the creation, and you can hear his work in every moment of every show, even when he isn't talking funny.
I stand by my position. He is a decent fellow, but his eyes are simply too garish.
Actually, nothing garish about Arun. He's so quiet, you'd often never know he was there if his brilliance weren't lighting up the whole room, plus the stench of his greasy lunches. Arun, we'll miss you.
Yes, we will. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Happy New Year.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Happy New Year.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.